Speechware Document 17. The Government's Right of Appeal in Criminal Cases. From the message of the President read at the opening of the second session of the 59th Congress, December 3, 1906. Another bill which has just passed one house of the Congress and which it is urgently necessary should be enacted into law is that conferring upon the government the right of appeal in criminal cases in questions of law. This right exists in many of the states. It exists in the District of Columbia by act of the Congress. It is of course not proposed that in any case a verdict for the defendant in the merits should be set aside. Recently in one district, where the government had indicted certain persons for conspiracy in connection with rebates, the court sustained the defendant's demurrer, while in another jurisdiction an indictment for conspiracy to obtain rebates has been sustained by the court, convictions obtained under it, and two defendants sentenced to imprisonment. The two cases referred to may not be in real conflict with each other, but it is unfortunate that there should even be an apparent conflict. At present, there is no way by which the government can cause such a conflict, when it occurs, to be solved by an appeal to a higher court, and the wheels of justice are blocked without any real decision of the question. I cannot too strongly urge the passage of the bill in question. A failure to pass it will result in seriously hampering the government in its effort to obtain justice, especially against wealthy individuals or corporations who do wrong, and may also prevent the government from obtaining justice for wage workers who are not themselves able effectively to contest a case where the judgment of an inferior court has been against them. I have specifically in view a recent decision by a district judge leaving railway employees without remedy for violation of a certain so-called labor statute. It seems an absurdity to permit a single district judge, against what may be the judgment of the immense majority of his colleagues in the bench, to declare a law solemnly enacted by the Congress to be unconstitutional, and then to deny to the government the right to have the Supreme Court definitely decide the question. It is well to recollect that the real efficiency of the law often depends not upon the passage of acts as to which there is great public excitement, but upon the passage of acts of this nature as to which there is not much public excitement, because there is little public understanding of their importance, while the interested parties are keenly alive to the desirability of defeating them. The importance of enacting into law the particular bill in question is further increased by the fact that the government has now definitely begun a policy of resorting to the criminal law in those trust and interstate commerce cases where such a course offers a reasonable chance of success. At first, as was proper, every effort was made to enforce these laws by civil proceedings, but it has become increasingly evident that the action of the government in finally deciding, in certain cases, to undertake criminal proceedings was justifiable, and though there have been some conspicuous failures in these cases, we have had many successes, which have undoubtedly had a deterrent effect upon evildoers, whether the penalty inflicted was in the shape of fine or imprisonment, and penalties of both kinds have already been inflicted by the courts. Of course, where the judge can see his way to inflict the penalty of imprisonment, the deterrent effect of the punishment in other offenders is increased, but sufficiently heavy fines accomplish much. Judge Holt, of the New York District Court, in a recent decision admirably stated the need for treating with just severity offenders of this kind. His opinion runs in part as follows. The government's evidence to establish the defendant's guilt was clear, conclusive, and undisputed. The case was a flagrant one. The transactions which took place under this illegal contract were very large, the amounts of rebates returned were considerable, and the amount of the rebate itself was large, amounting to more than one-fifth of the entire tariff charge for the transportation of merchandise from this city to Detroit. It is not too much to say, in my opinion, that, if this business was carried in, for a considerable time, in that basis, that is, if this discrimination in favor of this particular shipper was made with an 18 instead of a 23-cent rate, and the tariff rate was maintained as against their competitors, the result might be and not improbably would be that their competitors would be driven out of business. This crime is one which in its nature is deliberate and premeditated. I think over a fortnight elapsed between the date of Palmer's letter requesting the reduced rate and the answer of the railroad company deciding to grant it, and then 4 months afterward this business was carried in these claims, for rebates submitted month after month and checks in payment of them drawn month after month. Such a violation of the law, in my opinion, in its essential nature, is a very much more heinous act than the ordinary common, vulgar crimes which come before criminal courts constantly for punishment, and which arise from sudden passion or temptation. This crime in this case was committed by men of education and of large business experience, whose standing in the community was such that they might have been expected to set an example of obedience to law, upon the maintenance of which alone in this country the security of their property depends. It was committed in behalf of a great railroad corporation, which, like other railroad corporations, has received gratuitously from the state large and valuable privileges for the public's convenience and its own, which performs quasi-public functions and which is charged with the highest obligation in the transaction of its business to treat the citizens of this country alike, and not to carry on its business with unjust discriminations between different citizens or different classes of citizens. This crime in its nature is one usually done with secrecy, and proof of which it is very difficult to obtain. The Interstate Commerce Act was passed in 1887, nearly 20 years ago. Ever since that time complaints of the granting of rebates by railroads has been common, urgent and insistent, and although the Congress has repeatedly passed legislation endeavoring to put a stop to this evil, the difficulty of obtaining proof upon which to bring prosecution in these cases is so great that this is the first case that has ever been brought in this court, and, as I am informed, this case and one recently brought in Philadelphia are the only cases that have ever been brought in the eastern part of this country. In fact, but few cases of this kind have ever been brought in this country, east or west. Now, under these circumstances, I am forced to the conclusion, in a case in which the proof is so clear and the facts are so flagrant, it is the duty of the court to fix a penalty which shall in some degree be commensurate with the gravity of the offense. As between the two defendants, in my opinion, the principal penalty should be imposed in the corporation. The traffic manager in this case, presumably, acted without any advantage to himself and without any interest in the transaction, either by the direct authority or in accordance with what he understood to be the policy or the wishes of his employer. The sentence of this court in this case is that the defendant Pomeroy, for each of the 6 offenses upon which he has been convicted, be fined the sum of 1,000, making 6 fines, amounting in all to the sum of $6,000, and the defendant, the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad Company, for each of the 6 crimes of which it has been convicted, be fined the sum of $18,000, making 6 fines amounting in the aggregate to the sum of $108,000, and judgment to that effect will be entered in this case.